Part 3. The novelty of the court's procedural dereliction and its approach to stare decisis is matched by the novelty of its ruling on the merits. The ruling rests on several premises. First, the court claims that Austin and McConnell have banned corporate speech. Second, it claims that the First Amendment precludes regulatory distinctions based on a speaker's identity, including the speaker's identity as a corporation. Third, it claims that Austin and McConnell were radical outliers in our First Amendment tradition and our campaign finance jurisprudence. Each of these claims is wrong. The so-called ban. Pervading the court's analysis is the ominous image of a categorical ban on corporate speech. Indeed, the majority invokes the specter of a ban on nearly every page of its opinion. This characterization is highly misleading and needs to be corrected. In fact, it already has been. Our cases have repeatedly pointed out that, contrary to the majority's critical assumptions, the statutes upheld in Austin and McConnell do not impose an absolute ban on all forms of corporate political spending. For starters, both statutes provide exemptions for PACs, separate segregated funds established by a corporation for political purposes. The ability to form and administer separate segregated funds, we observed in McConnell, has provided corporations and unions with a constitutionally sufficient opportunity to engage in express advocacy. That has been this court's unanimous view. Under BCRA, any corporation's stockholders and their families, and its executive or administrative personnel and their families, can pool their resources to finance electioneering communications. A significant and growing number of corporations avail themselves of this option. During the most recent election cycle, corporate and union PACs raised nearly $1 billion. Administering a PAC entails some administrative burden, but so does complying with the disclaimer, disclosure, and reporting requirements that the court today upholds. And no one has suggested that the burden is severe for a sophisticated for-profit corporation. To the extent that the majority is worried about this issue, it is important to keep in mind that we have no record to show how substantial the burden really is, just the majority's own unsupported fact-finding. Like all other natural persons, every shareholder of every corporation remains entirely free under Austin and McConnell to do however much electioneering she pleases outside of the corporate form. The owners of a mom-and-pop store can simply place ads in their own names rather than in the store's. If ideologically aligned individuals wish to make unlimited expenditures through the corporate form, they may utilize an MCFL organization that has policies in place to avoid becoming a conduit for business or union interests. The laws upheld in Austin and McConnell leave open many additional avenues for corporations' political speech. Consider the statutory provision we are ostensibly evaluating in this case, BCRA Section 203. It has no application to genuine issue advertising, a category of corporate speech Congress found to be far more substantial than election-related advertising, or to internet, telephone, and print advocacy. Like numerous statutes, it exempts media news stories, commentaries, and editorials from its electioneering restrictions in recognition of the unique role played by the institutional press. It also allows corporations to spend unlimited sums on political communications with their executives and shareholders, to fund additional PAC activity through trade associations, to distribute voting guides and voting records, to underwrite voter registration and voter turnout activities, to host fundraising events for candidates within certain limits, and to publicly endorse candidates through a press release and press conference. At the time Citizens United brought this lawsuit, the only types of speech that could be regulated under Section 203 were, 1, broadcast cable or satellite communications, 2, capable of reaching at least 50,000 persons in the relevant electorate, 3, made within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general federal election, 4, by a labor union or non-MCFL, non-media corporation, 5, paid for with general treasury funds, and 6, susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate. The category of communications meeting all these criteria is not trivial, but the notion that corporate political speech has been suppressed altogether, that corporations have been excluded from the general public dialogue, or that a work of fiction such as Mr. Smith Goes to Washington might be covered, is nonsense. Even the plaintiffs in McConnell, who had every incentive to depict BCRA as negatively as possible, declined to argue that Section 203's prohibition on certain uses of general treasury funds amounts to a complete ban. In many ways, then, Section 203 functions as a source restriction or a time, place, and manner restriction. It applies in a viewpoint-neutral fashion to a narrow subset of advocacy messages about clearly identified candidates for federal office made during discrete time periods through discrete channels. In the case at hand, all Citizens United needed to do to broadcast Hillary right before the primary was to abjure business contributions or use the funds in its PAC, which by its own account is one of the most active conservative PACs in America. So let us be clear. Neither Austin nor McConnell held or implied that corporations may be silenced. The FEC is not a censor. And in the years since these cases were decided, corporations have continued to play a major role in the national dialogue. Laws such as Section 203 target a class of communications that is especially likely to corrupt the political process, that is at least one degree removed from the views of individual citizens, and that may not even reflect the views of those who pay for it. Such laws burden political speech, and that is always a serious matter demanding careful scrutiny. But the majority's incessant talk of a ban aims at a straw man. Identity-based distinctions. The second pillar of the court's opinion is its assertion that the government cannot restrict political speech based on the speaker's identity. The case on which it relies for this proposition is First National Bank of Boston versus Bellotti, 1978. As I shall explain, the holding in that case was far narrower than the court implies. Like its peons to unfettered discourse, the court's denunciation of identity-based distinctions may have rhetorical appeal, but it obscures reality. Our jurisprudence over the past 216 years has rejected an absolutist interpretation of the First Amendment. The First Amendment provides that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Apart, perhaps, from measures designed to protect the press, that text might seem to permit no distinctions of any kind. Yet, in a variety of contexts, we have held that speech can be regulated differentially on account of the speaker's identity, when identity is understood in categorical or institutional terms. The government routinely places special restrictions on the speech rights of students, prisoners, members of the armed forces, foreigners, and its own employees. When such restrictions are justified by a legitimate governmental interest, they do not necessarily raise constitutional problems. In contrast to the blanket rule that the majority espouses, our cases recognize that the government's interests may be more or less compelling with respect to different classes of speakers. The free speech guarantee thus does not render every other public interest an illegitimate basis for qualifying a speaker's autonomy. Society could scarcely function if it did. It is fair to say that our First Amendment doctrine has frowned on certain identity-based distinctions, particularly those that may reflect invidious discrimination or preferential treatment of a politically powerful group. But it is simply incorrect to suggest that we have prohibited all legislative distinctions based on identity or content, not even close. The election context is distinctive in many ways, and the court, of course, is right that the First Amendment closely guards political speech. But in this context, too, the authority of legislatures to enact viewpoint-neutral regulations based on content and identity is well settled. We have, for example, allowed state-run broadcasters to exclude independent candidates from televised debates. We have upheld statutes that prohibit the distribution or display of campaign materials near a polling place. Although we have not reviewed them directly, we have never cast doubt on laws that place special restrictions on campaign spending by foreign nationals. And we have consistently approved laws that bar government employees, but not others, from contributing or participating in political activities. These statutes burden the political expression of one class of speakers, namely civil servants. Yet we have sustained them on the basis of longstanding practice and Congress's reasoned judgment that certain regulations which leave untouched full participation in political decisions at the ballot box help ensure that public officials are sufficiently free from improper influences and that confidence in the system of representative government is not eroded to a disastrous extent. The same logic applies to this case with additional force, because it is the identity of corporations rather than individuals that the legislature has taken into account. As we have unanimously observed, legislatures are entitled to decide that the special characteristics of the corporate structure require particularly careful regulation in an electoral context. Not only has the distinctive potential of corporations to corrupt the electoral process long been recognized, but within the area of campaign finance, corporate spending is also furthest from the core of political expression, since corporations' First Amendment speech and association interests are derived largely from those of their members and of the public in receiving information. Campaign finance distinctions based on corporate identity tend to be less worrisome, in other words, because the speakers are not natural persons, much less members of our political community, and the governmental interests are of the highest order. Furthermore, when corporations as a class are distinguished from non-corporations as a class, there is a lesser risk that regulatory distinctions will reflect invidious discrimination or political favoritism. If taken seriously, our colleague's assumption that the identity of a speaker has no relevance to the government's ability to regulate political speech would lead to some remarkable conclusions. Such an assumption would have accorded the propaganda broadcasts to our troops by Tokyo Rose during World War II the same protection as speech by Allied commanders. More pertinently, it would appear to afford the same protection to multinational corporations controlled by foreigners as to individual Americans. To do otherwise, after all, could enhance the relative voice of some, i.e. humans, over others, i.e. non-humans. Under the majority's view, I suppose it may be a First Amendment problem that corporations are not permitted to vote, given that voting is, among other things, a form of speech. In short, the court dramatically overstates its critique of identity-based distinctions without ever explaining why corporate identity demands the same treatment as individual identity. Only the most wooden approach to the First Amendment could justify the unprecedented line it seeks to draw. Our First Amendment tradition. The third fulcrum of the court's opinion is the idea that Austin and McConnell are radical outliers, aberrations in our First Amendment tradition. The court has it exactly backwards. It is today's holding that is the radical departure from what had been settled First Amendment law. To see why, it is useful to take a long view.